You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Utah Beach, Sainte-Marie-du-Mont.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with, as ever, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And tonight we are joined by Kaylee Fretz from Velo News.
Hello, Richard.
From across the Atlantic.
Far away.
Action-packed stage. Got loads to talk about already, and it's only stage one. Lots has happened, hasn't it? We were played in by a bit of cello music there. You caught that, Kaylee, didn't you?
I did indeed. I was down at Utah Beach, and they had a little memorial. There's a big memorial. It was quite somber, actually, and poignant, and actually I was quite glad that they did that.
Yeah, it was immediately after the sort of presentation. There was Mark Cavendish was there in his yellow jersey, which we'll talk about in a moment or two. And there were some quite nice moving pictures of André Greipel, German champion, standing alongside Arthur Vichot, the French champion. And
a nice moment to end quite an incredible day, really, on the tour. So shall I just give our recap in the tail of the etape? Stage one of the 2016 Tour de France, from Mont-Saint-Michel to Utah Beach, the site of the Normandy landings on D-Day on June the 6th, 1944. Pretty flat stage, only two fourth category climbs, both coming in the first 40 kilometres. The sun shone, the wind blew a bit. The day's break was made up of five riders. Anthony Delaplace of Fortuneo Vital Concept, who's a local lad from near Cherbourg, and Seb Piquet tipped in our previous show that he would be on the attack this weekend. The other riders in that break were Paul Voss and Jan Bartha of Bora Argon 18, Alex Howes of Cannondale Drapac, and Lee Howard of I Am Cycling, who was the rider who started the move early in the stage. You may remember Lee Howard crashed out of the Giro and ended up in a watery ditch at the end of one stage.
Did he? He finished the stage.
He finished the stage, yeah. He pulled out a few days later.
He went for a swim mid-stage.
He went for a bit of a swim mid-stage. Anyway, he was a very late call-up for the Tour de France, stepping in for Dries De Venins of I Am Cycling, who is unwell, so Lee Howard wasn't quite expecting to be here, and got into that move. The lead was never huge. It was about 2 minutes with 92 kilometres to go, so it looked doomed. The big event of the afternoon, though, was 79 kilometres to go. Alberto Contador fell on a fast right-hander, and he hit a raised traffic island, ripped a big chunk out of his jersey. The bunch slowed down a bit to let him get back on, and he was quickly in the peloton, but he did spend some time back at the doctor's car getting taped up. With the King of the Mountain jersey secure after winning both the climbs, Voss dropped out of the break with 70 kilometres to go. And then with 55 kilometres to go, it was down to just Alex Howes and Anthony Delaplace. And they made a really good fist of it, helped a bit by a tailwind, stayed clear until just under 5 kilometres remaining. With 4 kilometres to go, I thought my prediction was going to come true because it was Etic's Quickstep against Lotto Soudal on opposite sides of the road. But then it all got a bit jumbly. Lotto, NL Jumbo and Katusha got involved. They look pretty well organized, very fast running, over 70 kilometers an hour at times. Inside the final K, there was a crash. Of course, there was a crash. For a while, it looked like Peter Sagan was going to get it, but then Mark Cavendish came surging through the middle, off Sagan's wheel. Marcel Kittel and André Greipel had no answer. Cavendish took his 27th Tour stage win and first yellow jersey. He also owns the green jersey, but that will be worn by Marcel Kittel tomorrow. Paul Voss is in polka dots, the King of the Mountains, and Ed Toynes of Trek Segafredo is in the white jersey. A few riders injured in that crash at the end. We'll find out more tomorrow, no doubt, but we do know that Ireland's Sam Bennett was on his way to hospital, so fingers crossed he's okay.
That's a chunky old tale of the etape there, Lionel. A lot happened for a first day.
It did, didn't it? It looked like it was fairly routine, but then Contador's crash kind of throws everything.
Yeah, through everything,
You're trying to then keep up with what's going on there.
We're going to talk a lot more about Contador's crash in part three. Kaylee and I have been examining the footage, some quite unusual footage taken from a roadside fan, which shows that shows what happened in that crash. It's very interesting. So we'll get onto that in part three. Let's talk about Mark Cavendish, because that was vintage Cavendish. That was the Mark Cavendish we saw between 2008 and 2011. You know, 2012... he won three stages here, but that kick, that acceleration, we've not seen that for a few years, and it's the first time he's ever beaten Marcel Kittel in a head-to-head sprint where they've both been going for the win.
I think an interesting point here is the fact that he has been doing all that track training, and they had a big tailwind, and it was a high-speed sprint, and I would imagine that the leg speed that he's built up over the last, well, 6-8 weeks of track training probably helped quite a bit today. And you're right, that was the first time we've seen him have that kind of explosive acceleration in quite a long time. He was also perfectly timed. I mean, Sagan went a little bit early. He was sitting in on the wheels as long as possible and then came around at absolutely the perfect moment, particularly given that tailwind. It was
perfectly. And Kittel, Cavendish had a sort of great lead out from Sagan. You know, Sagan did a sort of Mark Renshaw impression there. Kittel was coming up on the left and Cavendish could sense him. And when I saw Kittel emerging, I thought, it's game over for Cavendish. Once Kittel's up to full speed, you know, we saw at the Giro he was unbeatable. Cavendish sort of jumped and got a metre or two on Kittel immediately, and then, you know, won by over a length. It was a pretty conclusive victory. Somebody on Twitter pointed out to me that Kittel was in the wind a bit longer than Cavendish, so he made quite an effort to just to get up level with Cavendish when Cavendish made that jump. But still, very impressive.
But that was why the timing of his move onto Sagan's wheel was so perfect and so important. You know, he really did jump to get on that wheel. It was like he was sort of leaping onto a boarding, a train that was just about to leave the station. And he made that split-second move, got a little bit of help from being in the slipstream for just long enough. And as you say, Rich, everybody else ends having to come round in the wind and get past him. And it was a cracking sprint at the end of it wasn't one where it was all lined out by one team and it looked like a foregone conclusion from a long way out. There was a lot of things going on there. You know, Etix and Lotto Soudal, when they were side by side, they both messed it up a bit, really, because they were in position probably a bit too far out. Even though that was inside the final 5 kilometers, they just melted away, and Katusha came to the front with relatively few riders. Dimension Data didn't have a conventional train, and Cavendish sort of freelanced his way to victory.
It was a good clean sprint, wasn't it? It was the four fastest sprinters in the world, with the exception of maybe Christoph, although Alexander Christoph wasn't quite there, but the four, Greipel, Kittel, Sagan and Cavendish, and the four of them going for the line. And you can't say that it proves that Cavendish is the fastest of the four of them, because there were lots of other factors that came into play. And Cavendish, as you said, did freestyle it, although typically and characteristically he did pay fulsome tribute to his team. And we'll hear a little clip in a few moments from an episode we did earlier this year on HC High Road, because one of the reasons for doing that Friends special was the hook, really, was that at Dimension Data it was a sort of reunion of that team. And The old gang were back together: Bernard Eisel, Mark Renshaw, Edvald Boasenhagen, and those three were instrumental. I think they did a lot of work. Boasenhagen in particular got a really nice tribute from Cavendish. He crashed, unfortunately. He also mentioned Cavendish that they were wanting Boasenhagen to work for him, but not to expend too much energy and certainly not to lose any time, because he's got a real good chance in tomorrow's stage. But Kaylee, you went and caught up briefly with Bernard Eisel at the finish, the Austrian rider who speaks with a sort of Australian-German accent. Let's hear just a little bit from Bernard Eisel at the end of the stage.
To respect the jersey we're going to ride, Mark is not going to defend it. Let's see, we have Serge, we have Steve Cummings, we have Edward Barsnard.
Exactly.
Eddie crashed badly today, so...
Badly.
He hurt himself, and let's hope he's okay for tomorrow. But at the moment, Dimension Data for Quebec, so we're just enjoying that moment. We're always on the wheel of Quickstep or around them, and then we got on the side of them. Problem was that Team Sky came a little bit close with their lead out train for GC riders, so 2.2k's to go. Thing is, they're also good mates. I can't use my elbows or something. It's like, so I'm like, mate, could you please move? I'm like, we have something to do here. Probably used some different words, but we came back together, like, just right before 2.6k's to go. Reinhard von Rensburg on my wheel, like planned, Edward Boasenhagen, Rachel Kaff, and I heard there was a big crash 500 ago. I didn't see that. When you come in there, bro, nearly 80 k's an hour, and somebody goes down in front of you, you're not going to stop anymore. It's just like, this is like going, I think, 160, 180 on the highway, and you have to stop. No way. It's done. It was like, at the end of the day, we're not riding for the media or anything, and definitely isn't. And could also say it's a job, but it's like we're driven by this, and especially a first stage yellow jersey. It's more like he had a focus on the Olympics also this year, so it's double program, and everybody said this is going to be tough for him. It seems like it worked out, so but yeah, just happy. We're just, I think he's not thinking about now what they said, what they've written, or what people think. He's just, we just enjoy that day and have a good day tomorrow.
So that was Bernie Eisel talking about the win for his teammate and longtime friend Mark Cavendish. He wasn't too happy, Eisel, at Team Sky being up there with Chris Froome right towards the end. Geraint Thomas, I think, came off in the crash at the finish. And you had a bit more information on the crash, Kayleigh.
Yeah, this is just some intel from driving through the finish. We noticed that there were these sort of big red square bollards sticking out from the fencing quite far at handlebar level. And I took a quick look at the video once we got back to the press room, and it does appear that one of those, if it wasn't involved in the start of the crash, it definitely flipped a bike around and maybe made the crash worse. Driving through, it looked like those bollards were just perfectly placed to snag someone's handlebar at very high speed, particularly in a relatively narrow finish like that. So I think perhaps ASO may want to look at removing those little sponsor bollards there.
Yeah, they're sponsored by Carrefour, aren't they? The supermarket that also sponsors the King of the Mountain jersey. And I suppose the big question is whether those square cubes are hiding something, hiding a post and offering protection, or whether they're just there for advertising purposes.
They appear to just be filling a hole, basically. Mm. And you know, I think every single inch is used in those finales, and they should, like I said, I think they should probably take a second look at that one. I'm not entirely sure that today's crash was caused by them. There was definitely one that was shifted at some point during the crash, but I'm not sure it was caused by the bollard. But, yeah, not ideal.
Well, somebody who was there at the finish and certainly spoke a little bit to Peter Cavendish, Mark Cavendish's wife and mother of his two children, was Daniel Freeb. And I did say last night Daniel would be joining us on the rest of the podcast. He will be virtually and in reality. We haven't seen him yet. Is he here?
I'm sure he is here. I mean, normally you'd expect to see the hair silhouetted against the sunshine.
Television's Daniel Freeb. He's busy doing his telework, but we'll be catch up with him properly tomorrow. But in the meantime, he has sent us the what we're going to call the Freeboss file. Here is the first Freeboss file.
Hello, chaps. Hope you're enjoying yourselves without me. I'm still at the finish line. I'm still standing on the spot where about an hour and a half ago I watched Mark Cavendish's wife, Peter Cavendish, celebrating her husband's victory in this first stage of the tour very vigorously, as you'd hope and expect. The whole Cavendish clan was there. There were the three kids, Finn, Delilah and Frey. Mark's agent, who of course was very happy, as you can imagine. And it was an interesting and heartwarming counterpoint really to my little meeting with Peter an hour or so earlier, 2 hours earlier. I'd given her the fright of her life because I'd just watched Bernie Eisel, that's Mark Cavendish's teammate, his Dimension Data domestique. We've just got some red arrows flying over, actually, and that's the noise you can probably hear in the background, or whatever the French equivalent of the red arrows is. Yeah, I told Peter that Bernie Eisel had been struggling in the crosswinds, he was popped off the back, that he might not be able to give Mark any help in the sprint, and yeah, she was not particularly enthused at this news, as you can imagine. She said something to the effect of, oh, well, that's it, that's us finished. Unfortunately, Eisel was able to get back on, the team was able to regroup, and they really did a fantastic job in the finale, and it really reminded me of the Cavendish of old, the Cavendish of his best days, when of course he dominated sprints in the Tour de France, and just his coolness under pressure in those last 3 kilometres. There wasn't too much pressure on his team to take up much of the work and do much of the pulling earlier in the stage, and they were able to arrive quite late in the thick of things as the bunch came into Utah Beach. But Mark was very, very cool, ice cold, and he surfed all the right wheels. And his sprint itself, acceleration, really rolled back the years, brought back memories of 2008, 2009, 2010, the years, as I said, when he was really dominating the tour. And it's really, well, this is a metaphor that Cavendish often uses, but it's really the hundreds and thousands on the cherry, on the icing on the cake, because you get the feeling, okay, he still needs 7 stage wins to equal Eddy Merckx, his record of stage wins in the Tour de France. But now he's added the yellow jersey to his palmarès, and really that completes the Palmares in terms of the Tour de France. There's not an awful lot for him left to accomplish. He's won the green jersey. Of course, he's still got the Olympics later in the summer. That's obviously a major objective for him. But it's a fantastic start for Cavendish. It's a fantastic start for me as well, because I'm going to have to interview him most days this week. And I'm sure he's going to be in a much better mood from this point than he would have been if he'd lost, for example, to Marcel Kittel, who he'd never beaten until today. I'm very happy that Cavendish has won for personal, selfish, probably slightly unprofessional reasons. He, I'm sure, is absolutely delighted tonight.
Extraordinary stuff. Already he's disappointed that there's not a theme tune for the Free Boss file.
He's asking for a jingle, isn't he?
So we'll have to...
We'll
have to work on that. Just on Mark Cavendish, though, 27 Tour de France stage wins now. Well, he remains third in the all-time list of Tour stage winners, but now only one behind Bernardino, who's got 28. Eddy Merckx is still out in front with 34. Obviously, if you take all the time trials out of Merckx and Eno's wins, you know, Cavendish is miles ahead. You know, he's won more road stages than anybody else in Tour history. But of course, the big gap, and he did take issue with a colleague of ours asking about this.
He was as spiky as ever.
Yeah, he took issue a couple of days ago being asked about whether the yellow jersey was the last big gap in his, you know, in the list of things that he's won. Of course, the other big gap is the Olympic gold medal that he Olympic medal that he so desires. But it's one of the things that Christian Prudhomme's talked about, isn't it? About how the Tour hasn't really rewarded Mark Cavendish for that incredible dominance in the sprints. You know, the yellow jersey just never came with it, partly because time bonuses were removed, partly because there were uphill finishes perhaps on opening days or longer versions of the prologue time trial that would put the yellow jersey out of Cavendish's reach. And it does feel sort of appropriate that a rider who's won so many stages finally gets to pull on the yellow jersey.
Yeah, he's had a bit of unluck as well, as Fabian Cancellara would say, a bit of unluck, you know, especially in Corsica in 2013 when he was held up with a crash, and then I think he had a mechanical problem. So, you know, it's great to see Mark Cavendish in the yellow jersey. I think we've always said that he will be somebody who, once he's gone, we will say, we worked through one of the career of one of the all-time greats. He is one of the all-time greats, but you're reminded in the press conference of how awkward he can be and difficult. And a few journalists got stared down for asking what he obviously perceived to be stupid questions. It's just the narrowing of the eyes. I tried to tell him once about this, that you know, that he had the power to terrify journalists, and he acted as though he didn't have a clue what I was talking about, which I thought was very disingenuous of him. He was asked as well whether... He was asked a very syrupy question by an Australian TV journalist about whether he went through a few writers who'd paid some kind of tribute to Cavendish.
It was a long old list as well.
It was
wasn't
a long
it? It was
old list
embarrassing.
Of people. Whether it was nice to be respected by the writers in the peloton. And Cavendish paused as he does and said, to be fair, a lot of writers in the peloton who bleep hate me guts as well. Something like that. I paraphrase a little bit. We're not allowed to swear, are we? But anyway, it was quite funny and probably true. Shall we listen, just hear a little clip from our friends of this podcast special that was released earlier this year? It was a look back at HCC High Road, a phenomenal team that existed for a few years before ending at the end of 2011. And that was available to friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Here's a little clip.
Here was a top-level team that had no stars, was looking for every bit of talent they could locate and bring into the team. And it just doesn't happen very often.
A lot of the good riders in the peloton were high road riders. Any team would want them.
And we were taking a bet on a bunch of young guys. So why not a Cavendish? You know, he crashed in California and really tore himself up. He fought like a dog. I never forgot that.
Ugly jerseys. Horrible bikes, no team cars, nothing was working. I said, wow. I remember Bob said, I want to have a winning team. You have to win and win and win.
You know, this is a sport where everybody loses. When one guy wins, 180 guys lose.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com. Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the podcast. And they sponsor Pedaleur de Charme. And the Pedaleur de Charme today is, Kayleigh.
Am I voting or am I...
No, I don't think it's decided, actually. Okay. Paul Voss, yeah, Paul Voss, who is the King of the Mountains as well. But it'll be a big decision for him tomorrow whether he wears the polka dot jersey or the Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt.
I know which one I would pick.
What's that?
I know which one I would pick.
Yeah, well, you covet one of these Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts, don't you?
I do. Maybe I'll wear it tomorrow.
You're desperate for one. No, there were a few suggestions to Matteo Tosato, who put Alberto Contador, his Tinkoff teammate's insole of his shoe in his mouth for a while he was changing shoes. Which was, you know, that certainly, I don't know if that qualifies for Pedaleur de Charme, to be honest, but it was quite an interesting thing to have done.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd do that for you, Rich. You
know? Lee Howard, the swimmer, the Pedaleur de Charme from the Giro, was also nominated because he was only called up to 2 or 3 days ago and was the first man to attack. But Paul Voss is a winner. He's King of the Mountains. He rode very well. And I'll be honest, he's a friend of the podcast.
Wow. We're showing a bit too much of how this all really works.
My vote is still Alex Howes, who, as one of five Americans in the race
today...
Actually,
he was a nomination as well.
Was he?
Yeah. Good. Should because, we give it to him instead?
I think we should. Yeah.
Oh, hang on. You can't award it and then take it away and give it to somebody else.
Actually, Paul probably will be listening to this, so... Paul Voss is
Alex, we'll have to do something again.
We'll get Alex Howes another day. Yeah. I think he's the type of guy who should win it one day.
I agree.
I mean, there were nominations for him just for his helmet and sunglasses. I think that was ironic.
I mean, that's basically what I was nominating him for, yeah.
Yeah, deeply sarcastic. Yeah. They're an acquired taste, aren't they? Anyway, we were at the start today, Lionel, at Mont-Saint-Michel, the... Beautiful.
It's a beautiful little island in the sea.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little island in the sea. That's what I was. That's
like
the phrase
the Bahamas,
I was looking
yeah.
for. Stunning place. We weren't actually on it. We were just off it. But the riders rode from where we were up to Mont Saint Michel, where cycling is banned on Mont Saint Michel. But they got away with it.
It was funny, wasn't it? It didn't really feel like the Grand Depart. It felt
not at
like
all. It was like Corsica, wasn't
depart.
It?
Well, I wasn't in Corsica, but what struck me is that the Grand Depart weekend really belongs to Normandy because over the next couple of days, Sunday and Monday, we crisscross the region and before heading south. But there was no real heart, no real sort of focal point. However, I gather that the start and the helicopter shots of the rollout were spectacular. It was a lovely morning. The sun was shining, and yesterday's bad weather stayed away. So it was, but it was a very low key atmosphere. Down
I wondered
at the start,
if it was a security thing as well. It seemed there seems to be greater security, fewer people around the starts.
I think they're doing it. Yeah, well, they're doing a couple things. They're checking our bags on the way into the press room. First of all, that's new. And then it seemed to be at the finish today. They were sort of funneling people differently, like they were creating fewer access points or something like that. I will say that at the finish today, you know, finishing at Utah Beach, that was quite poignant for me. Anyway, it was sort of after the stage. A lot of the fans kind of moved away from the finish and went out to the beach, and a lot of, you know, just people sort of standing on the dunes there, staring out into the beach. It was a lovely moment.
Say, we're in a
today.
Press center, a marquee, 17 kilometers from Utah Beach. And I gather the reason we're not at Utah Beach, because there's lots of room, is for the overhead shots. We don't want any journalists in the picture. We would
this makes sense.
We would spoil
yeah.
the view.
Wow.
As we
I think
everywhere.
More the marquee that we were in would spoil the view rather than us, although, you know. So that's why we're out here. But there were beautiful, beautiful overhead shots as well. Now, at the start, though, another beautiful place, we spoke to a few people. You spoke to Rohan Dennis, who won the first stage time trial last year to take the first yellow jersey. So you spoke to him a year on from that, Lionel.
I did, yeah. BMC rider, Australian, Rohan Dennis, yellow jersey exactly a year ago. Well, not exactly a year ago, but on the equivalent day a year ago.
We get the point.
Well, somebody will say, oh, it wasn't exactly a year ago. It was on... and I'll be...
I'm going to tweet at you now.
Yeah, exactly. Kaylee will tweet me and tell me. But
I'll give you another grueling couple of hours on Twitter.
Goodness me.
Dealing with that.
Head slumped on table, rocking backwards and forwards. Just
giving, a normal day. Just giving this happens every day at some point.
Just giving the listeners a little insight into our world here on the Tour de France. It's only just begun.
Lionel's morale is very fragile. Careful what you say.
I'm in very good spirits. Anyway, Rohan Dennis was also in very good spirits. With all the predictions of wind, he was... you know, he was saying he wasn't nervous like he was a year ago, because obviously he felt he had a chance to win a year ago and this year he wouldn't. But I asked him a little bit about what a difference a year makes, and also about how BMC Racing are going to divide their loyalties, or divide their work more to the point, between two leaders, Richie Porte and TJ Van Garderen. Rowan, a year ago, a very different start to the Tour de France. You've probably still been in your hotel getting ready to go to the start in Utrecht. One of the best days of your career. Very different feel to the Tour de France today.
Yeah, a lot different. Obviously, no prologue this year, so it's a lot less stress. It's actually a lot nicer. Obviously, there's a lot of wind today, so there is stress. But it's pretty straightforward for me. Till stage 13, there's no holding back when it comes to helping TJ and Richie. And then stage 13, I can have a crack at that time trial. Other than that, it's no goals for me personally.
Yeah. How is the responsibility split between the riders when it comes to TJ and Richie? Because you've got two men who could finish on the podium, could even go better than that. Are you assigned to one or the other in the team? Is that how it works or not?
Obviously, we can't have seven guys assigned to TJ and leave Richie by himself. So we have to obviously split it a little bit. And ideally, we all make it obviously every stage without losing time, especially days like today. Say Richie gets a puncture, I think we'll keep guys with TJ, just make sure he doesn't have any issues, but a majority of the guys will go back and help Richie, or vice versa, just to make sure that we have as many bullets to fire when it really matters.
Lastly on today, the wind is blowing a little bit. What's the mood in the team regarding the conditions today? I mean, do you know what to expect out there?
Yeah, we've got Moinard, he's from Normandy, and he's given us a pretty good insight on what is to come. And as you can see, it's a lot like probably the first stage of the Tour last year in Holland, where it's probably going to split at some stage and maybe come back, maybe not. But there's two vital points along the road, and we're going to really look out for those two stages.
Is that where it's changing direction?
No, it's sort of just more open. So it's quite straight up the coast, and then we turn back inland, then come back down again. So it's the wind's coming from the left and then from the right towards the back end. So it's there's one going out, one coming back. There's two points, and they're the two points where we have to really be on our game.
So, Rich, who did you speak to this morning?
I spoke to Luke Rowe. I went to the team Sky bus. I was curious to speak to Luke Rowe and Geraint Thomas about the Welsh victory in Euro 2016 when they beat Belgium on Friday evening before the stage. They're obviously very happy about that. Dave Brailsford as well was very happy about that. He was brought up in Wales. He watched the game on the Team Sky bus and apparently made quite a racket, whereas the two riders who are not sharing a room, they watched it in their respective hotel rooms, very focused on the race, but obviously delighted by the results. So I had a quick chat with Luke Rowe, who had a very important role today. He did actually, in the end, come off in the crash with Alberto Contador, but he was okay. But before all that, I spoke to him at the start. Luke, the morning after, the night before, you were tweeting last night about looking for substitutes for you and Gary. Where did you watch the game?
We just watched in our bedroom. We were kind of nipping into each other's rooms throughout the game, trying to keep an eye on it. But a massive result for the boys and extra bit of inspiration for today.
How do you feel about today? Today is the sort of stage that suits you down to the ground. You've got a big job to do today. You seemed quite motivated when you came off the bus there, but is it a feeling of excitement mixed with a bit of apprehension as well?
There's kind of a few emotions thrown in the mix, you know. I think if I was racing purely for myself today and I was going for a result, I'd be absolutely buzzing for it, because if I didn't succeed, it's only me who have let down. But whereas today it's a case of obviously looking after Froome, that added pressure, and it's not an easy job to do. But at the same time, I'll, you know, relishing the opportunity to be here. And I think, you know, even if it does go bingo bongo and splits to bits, then we got the team for it and we got the guys to look after him. So either way, I think it's going to be a good day out.
How is Chris? I mean, you rode with him last year as well. Is he in a similar place, do you think, to last year?
I think a better place. Been no secret that he's had a quieter build-up and a later build-up, race less, in the hope to be better here, and I think he is. But again, time will tell. It's easy to say, and let's see if he can back it up, but I'm sure he will.
And you were sort of in that road captain role last year. Is that your job again on the team?
It is, yeah. So road captain again. I mean, it can be hyped up for more than it actually means. It's just a case of often just being a you know, the guy between the riders and the DSs in the car, and if a decision needs to be made out on the road, then do it.
Are you the one that sort of communicates most with the team car and then communicates that to the riders?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, and the DS is there, but I'm right next to the riders, you get to speak to them, and it's sometimes a bit crackly over the radio, so it's just a case of being there firsthand with the guys, and it's a lot easier to communicate on the road.
So you've got, obviously, Chris to look after, but quite a lot of other climbers, a very hilly, mountainous tour. Are you looking out for those guys as well today?
You know, it'd be nice to keep a few guys on GC. You know, Landers, he finished third in the Giro. We just won Paris-Nice. I think we got more than one potential winner for the tour. You know, why not? It'd be a shame for them to lose time so early on in the race, so hopefully they'll stay in the mix as well.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring us at this Tour de France and for the rest of 2016. In fact, there you are, you're resplendent in Rafa there. Kaylee, that's not even in your contract with us, but you are looking absolutely
the Rafa jeans.
Wonderful.
Yes, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you look great. Anyway, thank you to Rafa. They are wonderful partners, and already, you know, they're showing great enthusiasm in helping to support and promote the podcast, and they're up for it. And I should point out that throughout the tour, they are also doing a lot of really good editorial stuff. If you look at the hashtag on Twitter, hashtag more than a race, you'll find a lot of Rafa, great Rafa content, articles, stories, blogs on their website, rafa.cc. And we'll go into more detail about some of the things that they're doing, because some of them are really very good indeed and interesting. And if you're interested in the tour, you'll enjoy it, I'm sure. So we were going to talk in this part about Alberto Contador. Not the first time it's happened that he's crashed. Last year at the Giro, of course, he crashed in one of the early stages and damaged his shoulder, dislocated his shoulder, perhaps. There was a bit of vagueness about whether he actually did or not. And then in the 2011 Tour de France, I think he crashed on the opening stage and lost a minute or so. He didn't lose any time today, but it was a heavy old crash, and it wasn't as we thought. It was the peloton, it was 77 kilometers to go, I think, Lionel. You said 79, but I think it was 77 kilometers to go. I could be wrong. Sorry, Lionel's shoulders have slumped.
Tweeted them with the correct answer. How about that?
Anyway, it was around about, it doesn't really matter actually whether it was, it doesn't matter at all, does it? Whether it was 77 or 79. It makes no difference.
Get to the point.
Anyway, it looked as though the crash happened because they came out of a roundabout pretty quickly and there was a central reservation there, and Condor crashed into that. But he didn't. That wasn't what caused the crash, was it, Kaylee?
No, his front wheel just slid. It just disappeared out from underneath him. There's a fan video that's now circulating that someone was standing on top of a motorhome or something nearby and panned across the entire thing. Contador didn't hit anybody. He didn't hit anything. He just, front wheel was gone, and then he kind of rolled over that center median, and then it looks like he took, I think it was Brent Bookwalter from BMC out behind him, and one or two other riders, Luke Rowe. And so it was, I guess, really nobody's fault but his own,
or whatever he hit.
I mean, you know, just based on personal experience, I would guess that maybe he grabbed a bit of front brake and just lost the front wheel.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but that's pure speculation.
It was a heavy old crash, though, wasn't it? And he was pretty bashed up afterwards. His Tinkoff jersey was in quite a state as well, but he hurt his shoulder. The race doctor said only abrasions. I think he said at the finish as well that, you know, it was abrasions, but he will be hurting after that, and it will cause him a few sleepless nights or restless nights.
Yeah, and we always say, I mean, I know during the Giro we said who's ever won a Grand Tour in recent history after a heavy fall. Obviously Contador did do that in the Giro in 2015, but It's not a great start, is it? When all they would have been worrying about today is whether the wind would cause splits, whether time would be lost. But I would argue that hitting the ground that hard, and also because of the angle of that reservation, I mean, it was the perfect shape to really cause some bad bruising.
Yeah,
and he hit it full on the shoulder. And we will have to see how he goes in the next few days. And you know, we've got a slightly lumpy stage on, I think, Tuesday and another one on Thursday, and then, you know, suddenly it's the Pyrenees. There's not an awful lot of recovery time, and the GC riders just want the easiest possible route through the first week.
And he was in the right place, wasn't he? I mean, he was in the safest place, in theory, in the peloton, so he hadn't done anything. It wasn't an accident that came about through any kind of carelessness or lack of attention on his part. Just a freak incident could happen to anybody.
An accident, yeah. I mean, if you're going to crash any day this entire tour, though, if you go look at the route, I would pick today, honestly. I mean, at least he does have, theoretically, maybe a day or two to try to recover. If this happened a week from now, I mean, it could be tore over the next stage. Whereas tomorrow, it's lumpy, it's tricky, but he's probably not, assuming he can pull on the bars, probably not going to lose time. Definitely not ideal, but...
Yeah. Tomorrow, we bumped into Sebastian Piquet on our way out the press room there. Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour. He's the guy that calls the race in the cars over the official channel. He joined us on the podcast last night. He predicted Julien Alaphilippe to win Tuesday's stage. He also promised that if Alaphilippe wins the tour, which is unlikely, that he will walk naked into Paris. And we were wondering whether we could get him to fulfill some of that promise. If Alaphilippe wins the stage.
Top 10, maybe he could walk to Paris in just...
Underpants.
Just underpants, yeah.
And what if he wins the stage? What should we expect then? Topless?
We'll let him off that. And if
no shoes.
If Alaphilippe finishes in the sort of 50s or 60s, then he can walk into Paris fully clothed.
Fully clothed, maybe extra clothes. Yeah, right, we should wrap things up. Before we do, a new segment, corrections and clarifications. I owe an apology to Orla Shinoui, who I suggested last night was stuck on Mont Saint-Michel, missed the Team Sky press conference. I should have realised that Orla would probably hear about that, and she was quick on the phone to me today to... correct me, that actually they were booked on a hotel in Mont Saint-Michel, but they, realizing the potential danger of being stranded on Mont Saint-Michel, not being able to get to the press conferences, they changed it. So actually it was an example of her extreme professionalism. And we shouldn't upset
her.
And
an example of your rigorous fact-checking.
Yeah, we shouldn't upset her because she is our colleague on the cycling podcast Femina, and we've released one episode so far of that, a podcast dedicated to women's cycling. The next one will come out on the second rest day of the Tour de France, and there's a lot of really good stuff in that.
Just lastly, Rich, before we go, people ask why I dislike speculation so much and predictions, partly because anything can happen, you know, we've seen that today. In the eve of the Tour show, I said that Mark Cavendish, you know, had pretty much no chance of winning today because he's traditionally a quite slow starter in the Grand Tours. I mean, the facts do actually bear me out. I mean, obviously not today's facts, but previous facts that I was aware of at the time that I said all this. You know, he's I think only on two occasions, possibly three, has he ever won the first full-on sprint stage of a Grand Tour. So, and we've not seen any evidence. I mean, I'm quite happy to be totally proved wrong.
About which facts you like best, I think. Right?
I think we've seen that in the last couple of weeks. Not mentioning Brexit again.
Don't like my principles, I can get new ones. It's kind of the same thing. Before we go, we should also just quickly mention Leos Nano. We're on some beautiful folding bikes. They're made by a company called Leos, and the model is a Nano, and it's a carbon folding bike. We've been lent these for the Tour de France, and we've done two, I know. Well, may you look like that, Kayleigh. Jealous.
I'm super jealous.
Yeah, yeah,
we did. So you put it in the back of the car, you can ride press room to the finish line?
That's the plan.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the plan, yeah.
Yeah, but we also do a little morning ride, a stage, our own stage of the Tour de France. We started yesterday. I won the stage, and today I won again, didn't I, Lionel?
You did, yeah. I'm playing the long game. I'm hoping to win, so I'm in the third week.
Taking it
unlike
day by
Mark
day.
Cavendish, I hit the ground running. But no, it's great fun, and you know, it's going to keep us a little bit less unfit.
And yeah, it's a great way to start the day, isn't it? Just go and do a little bit of exercise after breakfast or before breakfast, perhaps, before what are really quite long days on the tour. And just a plug for our first Kilometre Zero, which is a sort of a day in the life of what we go through on the tour. That will be out on Monday morning.
Yes, it will. In the meantime, Kayleigh, thank you very much. We're going to be joined by you a lot at the tour, so get used to that.
As much as possible.
Maybe we'll get your theme tune another day. I mean, Daniel wants a theme tune. You've kind of insisted on a theme tune as well.
I'll bring it out next time, I
Excellent.
Promise.
Well, we look forward to joining us again. And Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Kayleigh.